All right, y'all, welcome to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Appreciate everybody tuning in today. All right. I'm looking at a lot of different screens and things, and I think everything is up and running. Oh, except I need to pick up the receiver on the phone and drop it. That was easy. All right. That's a lot of technical difficulties, but I think I got them all difficultied. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Check out the website, scotthorton.org. Keep all the interview archives there for you. 3,000 interviews and counting now at scotthorton.org. They're going back to 2003, that is. And if you want to be my Facebook friend, I'm at facebook.com/ScottHortonShow. That's Horton, like here's a who. And all of that. Also on Twitter and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow if you're interested in that kind of thing. And for God's sake, man, by all means, please join up the chat room. If you go to my website, scotthorton.org/chat, you will find... Well, if you go to my website, scotthorton.org, you will find scotthorton.org/chat. And if you go there, you'll find a built-in chat room right there. All you need is a fake name and fill out the CAPTCHA and you're in. In your preferred browser or whatever brand. You don't need any kind of external application or whatever. I know that used to be a problem for people at work. I can't really download XChat or Chatzilla onto my boss's computer, I'll get in trouble. Well, you don't need any of that no more. Just go to scotthorton.org/chat, and you're in. And I'll be keeping my eye out for things that you might be saying. Also, I got two good guests lined up for the show today. Trevor Tim from the EFF is going to be back to talk about some very important breaking news, as well as hopefully catch us up a little bit on the technicals of... the recent NSA revelations, of which there are more than a few to catch up on. So that should all be very good for you. But that's all in the second hour. And so what I want to do, if you guys are into it, man, is do some telephone calls on the show. I guess the question for today is, what should the question for today be? See, I'm not this kind of radio show host very well. I want to be. But I'm not very good at just saying, so what do you guys think about this one particular subject matter? How about you guys got anything to say about the prospect of a nuclear deal with Iran? How about you got anything to say about your anticipation regarding the breaking story of Glenn Greenwald's deal with a guy named Pierre Omidyar, billionaire founder of eBay, to create a brand spanking new media enterprise? Seems like that should be the question of the day. But I'll keep it nice and general. That should be the topic. But the question will be nice and general. What do you think? Say whatever you want about that. I'll tell you this. The guy told what's his name from what's it called that I tweeted earlier that he's going to put $250 million into it to start. Really? And Greenwald is going to be the sort of kind of publisher or something like that, I guess. Basically, the boss. Glenn Greenwald as Mr. White at the new Daily Planet. They've also, by the way, made it pretty clear that this is not just going to be a really big Greenwald blog. They're going to have sports and they're going to have entertainment and they're going to make it. This is like the Turner Network, man. This is a whole new thing. Only when it comes to investigative journalism, when it comes to the national security beat, the Bill of Rights beat, the killing foreigners beat, they're going to be hardcore instead of, you know, the Post and the Times. USA Today. If you're not too familiar with Greenwald, he's really good on the Bill of Rights, but even his Bill of Rights stuff for years has almost, well, I don't want to say that almost exclusively. Much of what he writes about any given subject, the lens is always the media criticism, right? So here I want to bring out the gallows for a bunch of politicians for the lies that they tell about Iran. And then I mention, yeah, the media just repeats it all like it's true. Well, Greenwald says, look at the lies that the politicians are telling that the media is repeating as true. And he takes the whole angle about the media uncritically passing on deceptive so-called information and fooling the people. So that's always been his thing. The Bill of Rights beat, the national security beat, and the civil liberties beat, but also with, you know, hey, everyone else in journalism, you suck at this. Start being less like Chuck Todd and start being more like Seymour Hersh. So, I mean, I don't know. What could it possibly take for Greenwald to blow this, right? No, this is going to be awesome. I don't know. Well, I'll give you the number. See, I shouldn't have ruined it. I should save my opinion till the end. Well, geez, guys, I don't know. Maybe it'll be drawbacky. Maybe it'll be problematicky. Well, I want to know what you guys think of it. I think it's awesome. I already let the cat out of the bag what I really think. I think it's great. So, you guys, call in. It's 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836 or 877-513-0792. 877-513-0792. It's the Scott Horton Show here on Liberty Express and No Agenda and Anomaly and a few other things too, include my own site, scotthorton.org. Go there and click on things. And by the way, if you're one of those people, and there are people like this, who finds themselves saying to themselves, wow, this guy Horton's good on everything, even his little asides about how much he hates Bill Clinton or whatever. I like all those too. This is wonderful. You guys should go and patronize my sponsors. Because otherwise, I'm out digging ditches for a living. But as long as the CNI and the FFF and everybody else knows that it's valuable to you, then they might be better relied on to continue to support so that this show might continue to exist. And speaking of which, I don't know if I have a short address for this or anything. You can find the link on my Facebook page, but my good friend Angela Keaton from antiwar.com has helped me to come up with this nice little sort of letter thing about what it's like to be me a year after leaving antiwar.com and how's the show going, and here's where all you can listen in the new time here, all about Liberty Express Radio and whatever, a little bit of fundraising pitch in there too, and so that's a nice little thing if you want to read that. Prospects for future growth and that kind of stuff. I guess I should blog that at the site. It only just occurred to me. In fact, maybe I could do it during the break. It shouldn't be that hard to do it real quick. Anyway. But yeah, so that's part of the website is scotthorton.org/donate if you're into that kind of thing. And we take bitcoins. For real. And by the way, I know bitcoins are pretty expensive each nowadays, but you can send fractions of bitcoins too. And fractions of bitcoins, they all add up. So we take bitcoins and we take monies. And you can use Google Wallet or WePay or Give or, of course, PayPal, whatever you want, if you want to do that. So there you go, scotthorton.org. Go patronize those sponsors. And hey, you know what? Sign up for the monthly subscription to donate just a little bit every month. Because, you know, the people that do that, that really helps. $10 here, $20 there. That's awesome. That's how there's groceries to eat. That's how the electricity's on. And I need electricity for running the computers. Otherwise, I'm going to have to, you know, plug an extension cord into the next door neighbor lady's house. And she's going to find out at some point. All right, I'm Scott Horton. One more time, real quick, the number is 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836 or 877-513-0792. 9-2. And did that work? It worked. Hey, I'm Scott. You're on.
Hey, Scott. It's Fitz in San Francisco. How are you doing?
I'm doing real good. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Yeah, it was, well, kind of a mixed range of emotions at first when I saw the news on anti-war about Glenn Greenwald's channel. At first, I was like, oh, no, because I thought it was great. You know, The Guardian, you know, they have several hundred thousand subscribers, and I was like, oh, you know, it's got really getting more, you know, more out there than you did under Salon. And so at first, I was a little disappointed, but after hearing what you just said about the $250 million and, you know, reading about the backer, you know, an Iranian, I guess he was a French, French-born guy, but of Iranian descent, and billionaire. I was like, well, at least he's got the backing, you know, where it's the, I don't want to say a curse word on, but, you know, say basically he's got, you know, F you money. You know, he can say whatever, you know, he's giving Glenn a point where he can, you know, do whatever he wants and not have to worry about, you know, being, you know, yeah,
well, and listen, the guy,
things like that.
He's not bulletproof, and, you know, he's got to have a price. I guess if you probably gave him $1 billion, he would write about how much he loves the Republicans or something like that. But for, I think, probably anything less than that, he's going to, it's so easy to assume. And you know what? Glenn's already got it all. I don't know what the Guardian's paying him, but he's got a comfortable living. It's not like he's got bunch of kids he's trying to raise or anything like that. You know what I mean? He's ready for, he's boiling for a fight and has been for a while. And as we all know, I think this is, you know, he wrote this back at the time when he left his own blog on claimed territory and went over to Salon.com. He said, and I think we all believed him, that he told Salon.com, thanks, I'm happy to do it. I get to say whatever I want, and I don't want to hear no complaining about it. And they said deal. And I don't know exactly what his arrangement with The Guardian was. In fact, I think he wrote about his arrangement with The Guardian about, you know, what very limited oversight over his you know, subject matter and whatever that they would have, whatever the restrictions were, they were pretty slight, and they were explicitly delineated, open and above board. So I think that, you know, it's almost like a scene from a movie or something. It's like something that it's too good to be true, but you know it's true that Greenwald told this Pierre guy, hey, listen, I've got conditions. You know, I'll take your $250 million, sir, but I have a few rules and obligations that you're going to have to live up to, right? You know he did that. You know he did that. So it's going to be great,
yeah,
man. It's going to be great.
At all, I definitely wasn't worried about it, about Glenn being bought off. I mean, I think I've had a chance to meet him once and just been reading for so long. I mean, it's clear from anyone who's read his stuff regularly that, you know, he's not going to cower to anybody. He's not going to hold back from anything. I mean, and so I wasn't worried about that. I was excited about hearing the quarter of a billion there, just because that means, this might actually be like a real thing to get up there and actually challenge, you know, be able to challenge some Fox and some of the other, you know, MSNBC stuff.
Right.
I mean, I have no idea what form it's going to be in, but I'm excited about it. I think it's
great. Well, I got to cut you off because your phone is going to terrible on us. But thanks very
no
much
problem.
For calling.
Bye.
I appreciate it. And look, the thing about the $250 million, let me tell you where that comes from. Again, 512-271-4836 or 877-513-0792 if you guys want to call in. I do want to know what you think about this. It's sort of, it's too obvious what we all think about it. It's perfect. It's awesome. But anyway, you may have something great to say about it, so I'm perfectly happy to hear it. Please call in if you want to call in. But so this is Jay Rosen at PressThink.org, PressThink.org, and apparently he has been talking, Jay Rosen has been talking with this Omidyar guy, the founder of eBay, again, is the guy. He has been talking with him, advising him on these issues. Apparently, the billionaire came to Jay Rosen saying, listen, I'm talking to some media people. I want to know what you think about this, that, and the other thing. So, you know, exactly what all role he played, I'm not exactly sure, but he turned around and interviewed the guy about the decision that he did make to approach Greenwald and make this deal. So, again, it's Pierre Omidyar is the guy's name, and he's a French-born Iranian-American, and he's a billionaire. He's worth about $8 billion. He's the founder or co-founder and is currently the president or CEO, but I think sort of, CEO emeritus or whatever, you know, permanent vacation ceremonial post at eBay at this point. He has a nonprofit foundation, and this is not part of that. This is going to be a new business venture. And what happened here, according to Jay Rosen here at, again, it's at pressthink.org. He says that this guy, first of all, and you may have read this at the Huffington Post, he had made a small online news magazine for Hawaii and was interested in media and this and that. And then the Snowden wrote, oh, and then the Washington Post approached him. Hey, you want to buy a newspaper? And, of course, Jeff Bezos from Amazon.com ended up buying it. Well, and so this guy Omidyar did not. But that really got him thinking about it. And then all the Snowden revelations came out. And he saw Greenwald and Poitras versus the world out there. And he said, you know what? We got to save the First Amendment before it's gone forever. And so the way that, and I'm getting to the point about the money. What he explained to Jay Rosen is he's willing to put up the amount of money that he was willing to pay for the Washington Post. Get that? Dig that? He's willing to put up enough money to build this thing as it would have taken to buy the Washington Post. $250 million to start. And again, it's going to not just be, you know, Greenwald and his investigative reporter friends either. It's going to be sports, it's going to be music and Hollywood and all of that crap and everything. A full-fledged news network only with, you know, testicular fortitude in the investigative journalism department instead of a bunch of whining Chuck Todd idiocy. Man, I'm so excited. Hey, I'm Scott. You're on the air, whoever you are.
Hey, Scott, it's Corky, man. How you doing?
Oh, good to talk to you, Corky. How are you?
Good. Hey, man, you know, this is a way of bringing people like yourself, Alan Butler, Pepe Escobar, mainstream, because we see you guys on TV a little bit, but not very much, and now it's going to really flush the rats out of the wall, because some of these other guys are either going to have to participate and maybe not have such a friendly atmosphere to participate in. All those hacks that are paid for by Raytheon and the rest of them to go on TV and say, oh, we need to do this, and we need to spend money, and we need to bomb these guys. I'm really excited about this because it brings people like you mainstream, and it brings all the scumbags out into the light, and now they're going to maybe have to face some, you know, maybe not such softball questions. And you know what? A lot of them probably won't appear, but who cares? We get the truth out now, man.
Right. Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. And did you have, by any chance, Corky, did you have a chance to look at Justin Raimondo's column today, The Case for Optimism?
No, I did not look at his column today, I'm sorry to say.
Well, all y'all ought to be reading Raimondo three times a week there at antiwar.com/Justin. And this one is The Case for Optimism. And one of the things that he really hits on is the power of the internet. And it is such a... Forgive me, libertarians, for the term. It's such a democratizing force as far as spreading out the power of information. And, you know, he links just to the front page of Empty Wheel at some point in there as the example of, you know, this is what happens when you try to feed us a bunch of propaganda. We unleash Marcy Wheeler on you, and you cannot withstand her. State power, she will debunk you, and where, you know, one day she'll grow old and die or whatever, she'll be replaced. They cannot stop the decentralization of knowledge and particularly of fact checking their assertions. And I think it's, you know, that's just one symptom of it. That's just one part of it. But it's just a brave new world out there. I mean, in fact, even look at who this guy is. Right? He's not some Rockefeller grandson or something like that from some old money. He's a guy who invented eBay and He's brand new money. And he's not a Pentagon contractor, right? He doesn't make fighter planes. He's not dependent on the Federal Reserve System all day. He's a free market entrepreneur. And what are they going to do about it? He can afford all the lawyers in the world that he needs, you know?
Yeah, I think the atmosphere is ripe for it. I think people are going to be shocked when they start seeing people like Marcy Wheeler and Justin Raimondo and Pepe Escobar and yourself start appearing and getting interviewed. People are going to say, well, where'd these guys come from? It's like, how come we never heard any of this before? I think it's really an exciting time, Scott.
Yeah, and like you say, too, all the Andrea Mitchells are just going to be left in the dust, right? People are just going to, why am I going to watch her asking the same old question over and over again when I got these guys talking about what really matters?
Yeah, and maybe one of the announcers on Greenwald will just call her Mrs. Greenspan instead of Andrea Mitchell.
Yeah, at some point, I'm sure they're going to get around to that. All right, hey, thanks for calling
well,
in, man. I appreciate
it. Good luck, Scott, man.
Appreciate it. Good to talk to you again. That's Corky, everybody calling in. And yeah, you know, it's still funny because it's still a horrible economic crisis now, but especially it was funny at the end of 08 and the beginning of 09, watching Andrea Mitchell on MSNBC every afternoon covering the crash and the economic crisis, and no disclaimer whatever, not once, not ever, that yes, it's true that my husband was the leader of the central bank up to just not too many months ago. What, maybe it was a year and a half at that point or something that Bernanke had been in there. But I guess, geez, it just went without saying that wasn't his fault, wasn't government's fault. Everybody knows that it wasn't the Federal Reserve's responsibility whatsoever. So what conflict of interest could she possibly have to disclaim? Anyway, actually, I would expect the Greenwaldians to cover that. They ought to call it the Daily Planet. And then Greenwald can be Mr. White. Hire Gareth Porter to be Clark Kent. It'll be perfect. It'll be perfect. All right, more callers coming in. Oh, no, I blew the break, didn't I? All right, wait. Here's the intro music back from the break that I just blew. All right. Blew the break. Future Freedom Foundation, very important thing. Council for the National Interest, also very important. And then what was the third one there that I missed? It would have been, WallStreetWindow.com, of course. The great Mike Swanson, investment advice there at WallStreetWindow.com. Sorry, guys, I blew the break. I wasn't supposed to do that. Okay, we got a couple of callers on hold here. Fixing to go to you, but first let me just tell the rest of them. 512-271-4836 is the number. 512-271-4836 or 877-513-0792. I'm Scott, and you are on the Scott Horton Show.
Hey, Scott, it's Andy from Brooklyn.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, I missed the very beginning, but I think you're talking about the new Glenn Greenwald venture.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I'm psyched about it, but I got to just give a little of the one trepidation I have is I really wonder, like, when it comes to Israel and the Israel lobby. I mean, I know Greenwald is, like, totally good on Israel, but I think that'll be the real litmus test to see if they'll allow, like, a Max Blumenthal, a really critical of it. Because I feel like, you know, that the new Max Blumenthal book, it's like, even on the progressive blogs, progressive stuff, like, that book's really getting no mention at all. And, I mean, I know Scahill's good, but he doesn't really talk too much, even with the defense stuff, he doesn't talk too much about Israel's role and all that. And you know what I mean? So, I don't know. I'm a little curious about how that'll play out.
Well, you know, first of all, I agree with you that Glenn has always been really good on Israel. If you think about his confrontation with what's his name in New York, Spitzer, about the Mavi Marmara, and I think it's something that not just he's good on it, but that he takes it very seriously as something very important, and it's also something that he's well aware is a real political hot potato. So I would have to assume that would be one of his specific conditions, that you're not going to stop me from talking about Israel now, kind of a thing, you know? I would hope so, and I would expect so.
Yeah, I mean, the climate's changing, too, like with the Syria thing and now with Iran, and I mean, it does seem like it's easier to talk about the Israel lobby and stuff, but I just sort of wonder, like, if you're talking about that size of a you know, media machine. You're talking about, you know, $250 million. Like, who are going to be the other backers, you know, the advertisers, whatever. Like, I just feel like the Israel thing. I mean, you know, even here in New York, like, you got Bill de Blasio, who's supposedly, like, liberal, but, you know, he's, like, a total hawk on Iran and on Israel just because of, like, his funding, you know. So that's the one thing I'm a little curious about, how that'll play out.
Right.
And I think, you know, even with at the Nation, I mean, they definitely kind of they're critical of Israel, you know, but they hedge it a little bit. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. Can't allow.
So that's the one thing but
Fitz in the chat room is joking.
Know.
They can't allow anti-Semites like Glenn Greenwald and Max Blumenthal on there. Those guys are gonna have to tone it down.
Really...
All right. Hey, thanks, Colin. Your phone sounds terrible, by the way.
Hey. Oh, sorry, man. Okay. All right. Sorry.
All right. Thanks for calling, though. All right. It's the Scott Horton Show. Anybody else wants to call in? It's 512-271-4836 or 877-513-0792. I like taking calls. I should do this more often. Don't you think? That's what kind of radio show it should be. It should be a taking calls kind of a show. We got, what, three or four in there? Ice is nice and broken for you guys. Go ahead and call in. One of the first comments I saw on Facebook yesterday was, oh, man, I hope it's not George Soros. And I thought, yeah, me too, because you know what? Even if Greenwald had a, yeah, but you have to leave me alone, let me do it my way, deal with that guy, no one would ever believe it. It would just sound bad. It would feel wrong. And so, thank goodness, it's this guy who's got no track record. Right? Not much of one. Other than apparently he's quite concerned about the NSA revelations he's been catching wind of lately. So, nothing wrong with that. Not by a long shot. And anyway, yeah, you know, Max Blumenthal, I can't imagine that Greenwald would allow him to be frozen out over being, you know, too controversial or whatever, because he's really not. You know, when it comes to and I mean this in a nice way. When it comes to positions on the typical American political subjects, I think Max Blumenthal is a more or less cookie-cutter progressive, right? He's not a hardcore Marxist, and he ain't no conservative. He's Sidney Blumenthal's son. And his opinions about Social Security and Medicaid and Medicare and all of those liberal great society type things are all exactly what one would expect of somebody like that, right? And I don't think he's for, you know, the state-controlled means of production or any kind of crazy revolutionary thing like that. He's, politically speaking, he's an all right guy. Yeah, his opinions on Israel seem to stick out, but you know what? The thing of it is, and I'm only just in the beginning of the book now, I don't know everything about it, but it's pretty clear to me that he's just being a good liberal Jewish boy. And the thing of it is he's continuing to believe one thing from one minute to the next, rather than flip-flopping around and changing his position to suit what he would prefer to have for whatever other social psychological type of reasons, you know? People do that a lot. Oh, killing people is wrong. Unless it's George W. Bush killing people. Then the younger the better. What do I care? Hooray for him. Or, you know, killing people is wrong. Unless you're Benjamin Netanyahu and your victims are Gazans, then... Oh, man, I didn't even hear the bumper music playing. Did you guys? Jeez, what the... Sorry, I'm kind of bad at this sometimes, I admit. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richman, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richman at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me you heard it here. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing, it's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire, the permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org.
Hi, I'm Brad Newman. I'm the creator of MyHeroesThink.com. Are you a fan of Ron Paul, Harry Brown, Murray Rothbard, Ludwig von Mises? Me too. These guys are my intellectual heroes, and because I can, I've decided to create my own monuments to them. So I'm bringing back the head bust. Visit MyHeroesThink.com and check out my artwork. Maybe you still have 5 empty inches on your bookshelf, or some space next to your computer. Maybe you'd enjoy having a statue of the libertarian who inspired you to think. Maybe you know a young person who just found these ideas and you'd like to inspire them with a gift. I really can't think of people with more integrity to look up to. Visit MyHeroesThink.com and sign up for the mailing list. Be the first to know when my Hayek and Hazlitt statues become available. Most importantly, be sure to type Scott Horton into the promo line so we can help support this show, because I'm sick of bombing people. Visit MyHeroesThink.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, this is my show. And yeah, you know what, I figured out what it was. It's supposed to play the Beastie Boys there. You know that extra little 30 seconds of drum kit at the end of Time to Get Ill. But what happened was I renamed the title of the thing, and then I forgot to update the thingamajig, and so the thingamajig didn't read the thingamajig, and the stuff didn't work. Anyway. All right, so, but hey, no problem. It'll work again soon. Next time. All right, I'm Scott Horton. You are on the air, but wait, don't say anything because I got to tell everybody it's 512-271-4836, 512-271-4836, or 877-513-0792, 877-513-0792, Scott Horton Show. We're talking about the Glenn Greenwald thing. Soon, Reza Marashi on the Iran Talks. Great news from the Iran Talks. Well, pretty good news, I guess, from the Iran Talks. And Trevor Tim from the EFF is going to be here to talk about NSA stuff too, so hang tight for that. All right, now you can talk. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott, this is Dennis calling from Michigan. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks for calling. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you, thank you. A couple things that I've noticed here recently. One is the information on Iraq, a couple of very interesting but very sad articles about Iraq at antiwar.com. The one talking about how the new report showed that the casualties there were like 50 times higher than what most Americans think. And then Kelly Baker-Lajos, I think that's her name, had the article about, she's tossed aside like an old, used girlfriend or something like that in the foreign policy political circles, So I'm looking at that and I'm thinking about how sad, how tragic all that is, and then wondering about the situation with Syria and if we're going to still see some sort of November surprise or somewhere down the road where Obama tries to pull something out of his hat to create more war there. But then from what you're saying, I guess what we're hearing about Iran, maybe if the Iran thing got somehow fixed, that would make it less likely that they would do something in Syria. But then I'm thinking too about what Tom Englehart was writing about, or maybe it was one of his writers talking about how the whole Iran thing with Netanyahu going ballistic was really just another smokescreen to cover up what Netanyahu's doing to the Palestinians.
Yeah.
So I don't know, how do you see it all fitting together, Scott?
Well, first of all, on the Iraqi casualties, this new study, I have a call-in to him. I wanted to see if I could get him on the show to talk about it. They say it's 400,000, which that's what the Lancet and Johns Hopkins estimated back in 2004. And then by 2006, they estimated a million, or no, no, no. By 2006, they estimated it was 650,000 that had died. And then by the end of 07, beginning of 08, it was Opinion Business Research in the UK that determined that a million had died. And now that's excess deaths. That's not all shot by U.S. Army. But that's excess deaths if you take the rate of death from before the invasion and then compare afterwards. This is, you know, apparently this many more people dying. So that includes from a lack of health care, from a lack of just ability to get to the hospital, you know, when you're bleeding because of the six checkpoints and the war between here and there and that kind of thing. Or, you know, and just the presence of more disease due to a lack of infrastructure and clean drinking water and electricity and all of those things and just the deprivation that comes with wartime. And so now this new study is coming out at a bit calmer period compared to, say, 2007 or 8 anyway. And they're saying it's 400,000, which, as you say, is still at least four times as much as what the American people have been told by their government, which is 100,000. And that's just coming from what it said in the WikiLeaks from Bradley Manning, Chelsea Manning's WikiLeaks there from the Iraq war logs. So nobody ever said, by the way, that those war logs were a total. That was just how many the American military had counted when they were bothering to count. And, of course, they lied when they said they weren't counting. And not only were they counting, but they were basing their war strategy off of it. Oh, well, we got a good body count today. The same old ridiculous fallacy as the Vietnam War, just as though killing people in general makes them less, the survivors, less willing to fight you, which made no sense in Nam and didn't make any sense in Iraq either. But anyway, so the real point is, you know, and a good friend of mine in 2004 said to me, just wait, man, you'll find out it'll be worth it because Iraq is going to be so much better off when we're done and this and that. And I said, well, you know, they're saying it's already 100,000 dead, you know. And he said, huh? Oh, my God, 100,000? Really? And I said, yeah, man. And then so you got to ask yourself, how many 100,000 is worth it? You know, what are we talking about here? And are you sure that this is even a civil war between modernity and the old way anyway? Because it looks more Sunni Shia to me. And anyway, i.e. more Iran versus Saudi to me, that kind of thing, power axis wise. And so, yeah, I mean, that's the kind of thing that people got to take into account when they're playing out their sociological fantasies on other people's societies with the Marine Corps is, well, geez, how many people are going to have to die in this thing before my magic wish comes true? And then, you know, you might even remember from the Iraq War, if you care to remember, that it didn't work out. All that killing and all that arguing. No, we can't cut and run now, Dennis. We can't cut and run now. It'll be worse if we leave now. As hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people were dying because we were there. And as the only people willing to look back on it are people, you know, for the most part, are people like you and me and Kelly who want to emphasize all the lessons that it didn't work. Everybody else wants to pretend that it happened back in the days of black and white TV, back Truman, before Eisenhower even, somewhere around the time of the Korean War. I think there was a war in Iraq, but that's all ancient history now, and who cares about that, and I don't want to think about it anymore. And you can see why. You know, all those lies and all that arguing on behalf of lies, on behalf of destruction and waste and horror, and not only that, but just getting the entire 21st century off on the completely the wrong foot in every way, being the greatest force for evil on the planet Earth at the dawn of the 21st century. There's a lot to want to forget there, but, you know, it seems to me like it's worth pointing out. And I don't really know, you know, the excess deaths, whether it's 400,000 or whether it was a million. I mean, a million always sounded high to me because that's a big number. But then again, that's a lot of people dying. And that's a lot of people forced out of their homes. That's a lot of people kidnapped and held for ransom. That's a lot of people tortured to death with drills through their eyeballs. at the hands of Rumsfeld's Wolf Brigades. That's a lot of violence that went on there for year in and year out through that entire Civil War from March 2003 through really right now. So, you know, I don't know. Who's to say? And you know what? At some point, you can only hang George W. Bush for his war crimes so many times in a row, right? 400,000 counts of murder versus a million. We start getting into Stalin statistic land at that point. When your mountain of skulls is so high you could never climb to the top of it, then yeah, that's high enough. You also asked about the Syria thing. Well, they're saying 100,000 people have died in that one. And I don't know, you know, that's UN numbers. The UN numbers were like 80,000, and then the actual pro-rebel propagandist at this Syrian so-called Observatory for Human Rights there said, no, it was only 70,000, but then that was about 6 months ago now. And then I don't know if it was the UN or who it was, maybe it was the Red Cross that came out and estimated 100,000 killed in that one. Now, to me, that doesn't sound as believable to me because I'm comparing, and you know what, I don't know, I'm just a lowly radio show host in Texas comparing news coverage and whatever, my best reading of the news coverage. And I have trouble seeing the levels of violence in Syria being at the scale that it was in Iraq in, say, 2005, 6, 7, like that, when you had a million, you know, hundreds of thousands of people dying, thousands and thousands of people killed every month. Undeniable. It was undeniable. There were giant stacks of bodies like cordwood everywhere. I don't know. Maybe it really has been that bad in Syria, but it seems like maybe that's a bit of an overestimate. But then again, it's at least tens and tens and tens and tens of thousands killed, more than a million refugees, and complete horror and deprivation. And I don't know if the state of Syria will ever last through this. How much nationalism is there left in Syria for people to rally around, where their identity as fellow Syrians and fellow men with each other can override their previously existing divisions that have now been so badly hardened by the few years of really American-created war there. I don't know. People are saying there will never be Syria again, Dennis, and I don't know whether that's really true or not. Might not, you know?
You know, it might not, Scott, and yet that for some people in the war party, that doesn't seem to ever stop them. The consequences of what they're doing, because they're the would-be masters of the universe, and everybody else is just there to serve them and to be, you know, tools for their use, and they just consider the casualties as, you know, collateral damage, and they clearly have shown with their consistent outrages that they've perpetrated.
Right. You know what?
Allegedly for everybody else's own good. They don't give a damn, really.
The thing is, you know, I know you're a Republican, but what's funny is you kind of sound like a commie talking about, well, you know how the rich are. That's what they'll do. And the thing is, the commies are right about the rich. That's exactly how evil they are and exactly, you know, how far they're willing to go. And government employees are no different. Because what is it about being, and we're talking about really wealthy here now, powerful wealthy, not just somebody with, you know, some, you know, a successful business or something, but, you know, somebody who's powerful enough to own a senator or two in private life. What is it that they have in common with their government counterparts? Power. The ability to exercise power over others. It's not just the control of wealth. And, you know, I'm embarrassed, but I remember this from reading The Great Gatsby in high school, where in that part of The Great Gatsby where he's trying to explain that rich people really are different from other people. And you don't have to be a commie to see it this way. But if you're raised your whole life knowing, you know, being taught and knowing it's true that actually you're so wealthy or you're going to inherit your father's senator's chair or whatever, and you're going to have so much power that the decisions you make are going to get people killed, are going to put people out of work, are going to determine future paths of the nation, of the society, of the world. That you do have that much influence as an individual, then you have to learn to accept very early on in life that, well, you know, like an army man, I guess I'm just going to have to kill some people. That's part of my job. like a hitman, like a soldier, like a congressman, or a senator, or a banker, that this is what I do. Some people are going to have to get really hurt, and now that I've accepted that, great. Now we can move on to the hurting, and then now we can have a contest to see, you know, who can exercise the most power, you know, who can hurt people the most, and who can get away with the worst. That's the whole game to me. I mean, that's what Washington, D.C., that's what all that marble is doing there, you know, is celebrating that exactly.
Right, and then when you look at, you know, the judge Napolitano talks about the Latin phrase for the lust to dominate. I think St. Augustine came up with that. And that's a, I think that's a theme or a thread that ties together people, many of them, not all. I mean, there are the market entrepreneurs that just look to do good stuff, but, you know, the political entrepreneurs and, you know, the corporate state, the fascists, if you will, in that corporate world, along with the political ones, and of course they move back and forth, and at all levels, including the lobbyists and the people that are in the Defense Department and the other bureaucracies and all that sort of thing.
Right.
But it seems as though they just you know, have a competition to see who can outdo each other there. But it might be maybe the weight of their misdeeds showing up financially in other ways, that the whole thing is just going to collapse. And even with some of these secession movements that are growing now, some very interesting stuff happening. Well, both, you know, the nullification of the 10th Amendment Center, like dealing with the, you know, NSA and all the other things, you know, and then, you know, you had Dan Johnson with, you know, Panda. I mean, all these groups now that are fighting back and people are waking up, and there's a ray of hope there. And,
you're right.
And it may be that...
Yeah, everybody, don't listen to me. You should listen to Dennis, you know, because my problem is that I'm just too damn jaded, and I just, it's hard for me to see the silver linings in any of this stuff anymore, and the, you know, everything never changes and whatever, but I'm wrong. That's stupid. Look at what just happened. We just stopped the war in Syria. That wasn't Putin stopped it. That was, Barack Obama was desperate for a way out of this. Because the American people wouldn't have it. And the Congress, too. Even the Republicans. You know, Bill Kristol went on Fox News Sunday and said, oh, yeah, right. I bet 5 Republicans vote with Rand Paul against this thing. Well, really, because the minority leader Mitch McConnell lined up with Rand Paul on it, and so did the super majority of the Republican Party in the Senate. They were prepared to vote no. They were going to vote no, and it was Putin only saved Obama from that. And that's just one victory, and you're right. You talk about the 10th Amendment Center. They're getting all kinds of victories from the bottom up, and I know you're a big part of that movement up there in Michigan, pushing back against NSA spying and against possible NDAA kidnapping. And the rest of this stuff. So, you know, just because the only thing I can do about it is complain into this microphone all day doesn't mean that's all anybody can do about it, because you, for one, are proof that that's not true, Dennis.
Well, Scott, let me just say quickly, there are two things. One is I've been channeling my inner Horton and saying I'm going to go out and start complaining about stuff. So I've been where I can't get into meetings and bring up a lot of these important points that you bring up. So you do great work with being inspirational and informational. Secondly, I just wanted to mention to the folks listening, and I know we have different ways of fighting back against this, but one of the things that we're doing here locally is building on something that happened during the fight against Obamacare and Medicaid expansion. In our 9th District Committee, we got through a resolution, which I thought was a pretty good one. I'm kind of surprised that the wording got through the way it did, but it was, I think, pretty good, talking about there's no reason to go to war with Syria. And on top of that, and the same way we should, only the General Butler said, you know, defend our homes, defend the Bill of Rights, that sort of thing.
Right.
If he tries to do something without a constitutionally mandated declaration of war, that's an impeachable offense. Now, I understand what some of the objections might be to looking at the Constitution, but I still think since they take an oath of office to uphold it, if we can utilize that as a standard, I think we can do some good things and maybe rile the people up.
Sure.
And we had it through our one district. We're going to try to get that in other districts. So people go to your Facebook page and see that maybe they can get other organizations. It doesn't have to be, you know, political parties, but just get people to write and say, hey, we know it's calmed down for a little bit, but it ain't over. And these people should know we're drawing our own line in the sand. They can't get away with this anymore.
Right. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And thanks for the call. I'm going to go ahead and move on because see if we can get one more call in here before the top of the hour. But
bye-bye.
I appreciate it, Dennis. Very much. And look up Dennis Marburger, just like it sounds, is how you spell it. Dennis Marburger. Look him up on Marburger. I'm sitting here slurring his name like a drunk. Dennis Marburger. Look him up on YouTube and check out all of his great speeches. He really gives inspiring speeches. And you can. I saw one recently where he's telling the group all about Well, he's just informing them about the way it's supposed to be compared to the way it is now, and how, and I believe it was on the subject particularly of the National Defense Authorization Act, and the, which is the NDAA has become shorthand for the particular power in there since 2012, supposedly delegated by the Congress to the president to abduct you or any American citizen or any U.S. person and have them held indefinitely without trial or charge by the military. And anyway, good stuff. And boy, you want some to participate in that, especially if you're there in Michigan. Join forces with Dennis Marburger and his group. In fact, I guess it's too bad he ain't there no more. I was going to say, dude, come back and tell me where they can get a hold of you again. Anyway, you guys got your Google search. You can find him for real. All right. Anybody else wants to call him? You still got a little bit of time? Oh, no, I'm going to burp. Hang on. That's from all that Dr. Pepper I drank. I know that the experts say you're not supposed to drink Dr. Pepper while you're doing a radio show, because otherwise then that might happen. But that's what mute buttons are for. All right. I want you to call in if you want to call in. 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. Or 877-513-0792. 877-513-0792. Really, you can talk about the Iran talks or whatever you want if you want. Basically, the question of the day is about Glenn Greenwald. What do you think about the new Greenwald project? Again, it's a billionaire, founder, inventor of eBay, named Pierre Omidyar, who is the backer of this. He's told Jay Rosen from PressThink.org that he's willing to put up $250 million for this thing. It's also been announced, revealed here, there, and the other place. Let's see, Hosenball had a piece in Reuters, and then somebody had something at Huffington Post. And anyway, you could have guessed, but Jeremy Scahill and Laura Poitras, the documentary filmmaker, will also be coming on board. So, sounds to me like it's going to be a real big deal. And with that much money behind it, they can basically create their own new Ted Turner network, right? They don't have to settle. They could create something on the order of, if it may very well be just an online venture, but still, it could be, you know, it will be on the order of the Huffington Post in size. You know what I mean? And I cite that as an example just because they went from 0 to 6,000 miles an hour in an instant over there. And then I think sold it to an Israeli investment firm and stopped doing journalism after that. But anyway, you know, these things happen. All right, so yeah, I'm Scott, and this is my show. 512-271-4836, 512-271-4836, or 877-513-0792. And again, if you're too shy to call in the show, you can still join up the chat room at scotthorton.org/chat. You can send me a tweet at /ScottHortonShow. Participate in the show however you want, if you want. But if you don't, I'm going to go ahead and, well, this is your punishment for not calling in. I'm going to read you Greg Thielman. Now, Greg Thielman was at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research, the State Department's own little CIA, and told the truth about Iran's so-called nuclear weapons program, particularly on the aluminum tube issue, but I think on other issues too, the Niger uranium issue back in 2002, 2003, could have stopped the war if anybody paid any attention. But anyway, so finally, serious negotiations in Geneva on Iran's nuclear program. This is from progressiverealist.org. Officials from the P5 plus one countries meet with Iranian officials in Geneva on October 10th. I guess they meant met, or maybe that's supposed to be the caption of the picture, but it's just the text of the article. I don't know, man. Based on available evidence, the atmosphere and content of the 2 days of six power talks in Geneva with Iran's new negotiating team bodes well for the chances of achieving an acceptable resolution to the Iran nuclear crisis. Not that it's really a crisis, but, you know, fake crisis. Although full details of the exchanges are not available and the two sides have agreed not to reveal the details, it is clear this round was different than others conducted during the past 2 years. In her closing press conference, UN High Commissioner... Oops, how did I say that? UN High Representative, which, you know, it rhymes with commissioner. In her closing press conference, UN High Representative for Foreign Affairs, Catherine Ashton, described the talks as intensive and important, and the most detailed we've ever had. Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister, Syed Abbas Araghchi, not a Japanese guy, huh? All right. Took note of the highly positive atmosphere. In the joint statement issued at the conclusion of the round, the negotiations were described as, quote, substantive and forward-looking. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif opened the first day with a one-hour PowerPoint presentation offering a roadmap for resolving the nuclear controversy. In addition to the plenary sessions, the meetings included several bilateral sessions between Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Araghchi and other P5+1 representatives, including U.S. Undersecretary Wendy Sherman. The talks were conducted in English. Notably absent were the long lists of grievances sometimes delivered by Iranian negotiators in the past. Ashton's emphasis on the need for confidentiality in the talks and the apparent success at achieving it suggests the sides were more interested in talking to each other than in justifying themselves to the public galleries. If the two sides maintain serious and sustained negotiations, a framework agreement to resolve this long-running dispute over Iran's nuclear program could be firmed up by the end of this year. The parties announced they are committed to meeting again in Geneva at senior levels in 3 weeks, November the 7th through 8th and 8th, and to holding expert meetings in the interim. The basic framework of an agreement would likely include Iran's acceptance of significant limits on its enrichment of uranium, including a halt to the enrichment of uranium to 20% and to more normal fuel grade 3.5, limited to more normal fuel grade. I don't know what he means, more normal. More than normal. That's electricity grade, industrial grade, 3.5, 3.6%. And increased transparency for monitoring Iran's nuclear program. For their part, the six powers would recognize Iran's conditional right to continue enriching uranium for peaceful purposes and to remove economic sanctions that have been imposed as a result of Iran's nuclear activities. While Congress will be reluctant to lift these sanctions until the latter phases of any deal, the President of the United States has the necessary waiver authorities on key oil and financial sanctions that can be exercised when and if Iran implements agreed confidence-building steps. The skeptics of negotiating with Iran will continue to make unrealistic demands and point to the lack of concrete progress out of this one round of talks. But this is clearly the successful start of serious negotiations. A negotiated deal is clearly the best option on the table to guard against a nuclear-armed Iran. While there is time for negotiations, the time should not be wasted. There is an urgent need to agree on confidence-building measures, such as limited sanctions relief and halting 20% enrichment. This is necessary both to maintain momentum in the talks and to create political space in capitals while the details of the framework outlined in Geneva are filled in. In the days and weeks ahead, the leadership of the seven countries, meanwhile, must remember that success will come from accepting what is most needed, not from demanding what is most desired. Well, there you go. So, thanks for not calling in and interrupting me. I'm glad I read that whole thing. I'm pretty positive about it because, I don't know. The Iranian position hasn't changed. What's different is it seems like the Americans might be willing to finally stop being such dicks and accept Iran's acceptance of their demands, you know? What could be wrong with that? Yeah. they never were making bombs. So it's not like they have to negotiate away their ability to make bombs. They're not worried about that. They never were worried about that because that wasn't the deal. And you know what? They're not going to give up their enrichment. And yet, I think all the leaks are that Obama accepts that. Because what can he do about it? Oh, man. Where's my commercials? Where's my music? What is wrong with this freaking thing? Oh, I know what happened. I screwed up really badly. That makes sense. I wonder if they're going to play it all. Man. Sometimes I'm really bad at broadcasting. All right, well, I'm going to have to play something for you, ain't I? Here, listen to this for a second. This is Jeff Riggenbach reading Murray Rothbard's Chapter 14 from For New Liberty. Oh, no, wait. See, there's the commercial kicking in. Boy, what a mess. What a terrible show, Scott Horton. You suck at this. God dang.
Hey, all Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for Braswell Business Communication Services at FusePowder.com. Braswell Communications can provide a credentialed media presence for your company at industry conferences and trade shows, as well as support services and consultation for publishing, editorial and technical writing, business-to-business and marketing communications, research, and information campaigns. Braswell also does website development and complete web content maintenance to include voiceover audio and copywriting. Strengthen your business. FusePowder.com.
Hey, all Scott here, inviting you to check out Modern Times Magazine at moderntimesmagazine.com. It's a great little independent publication out of Phoenix, Arizona, featuring unique views on economics, politics, foreign policy, sports, and music, with great art scene coverage and fiction writing as well. That's Modern Times Magazine at moderntimesmagazine.com.
All right, I might really suck at broadcasting sometimes, but I've got an impeccable taste in guests. And most of the time, I try to leave my mic off while they're talking so that I'll let them talk instead of talking over them. Doesn't always work out, I admit. But I try. All right, it's the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. ScottHorton.org is the website. 3,000 interviews there going back to 2003. And our first guest on the show today is the great Trevor Tim from the Electronic Frontier Foundation and also from the Press Freedom Foundation, or the Freedom of the Press Foundation, or whichever it's called, it doesn't match the URL. Anyway, welcome back to the show. Trevor, how are you doing?
Great. Thanks for having me back.
What did I do with the... Oh, here it is. It's the Freedom of the Press Foundation at pressfreedomfoundation.org. Somebody needs to fix that. Please.
Yeah, the URL has caused great controversy. Unfortunately, Freedom of the Press Foundation is too long.
Well, why don't you just change the name of the foundation to the Press Freedom Foundation?
Yeah, and there might be some other organization called that. It's it's a long, hard battle. We're still
maybe
not
you could
over
be,
fighting. We'll see.
You could be the FOTPF.
Yeah, that just rolls off the tongue, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's perfect. All right, I'm sorry. I'm just not even being funny. I'm trying. Anyway... Trevor Tim, you do great work, and the first thing I want to talk about before we get to all the EFF and the NSA and the this, that, and the other acronym is this new open source submission platform that you guys announced yesterday there at PressFreedomFoundation.org. Tell us all about it.
Yeah, well, so this is an open source submission system, like you said, that would allow sources and whistleblowers to securely and anonymously digitally send documents to journalists, a la the WikiLeaks system that was pioneered by WikiLeaks, you know, over half a decade ago. You know, since WikiLeaks, you know, kind of came under attack from the U.S. government and had to pull their submission system online, there's really been no news organizations that have successfully deployed a similar system. And so there was a system created by the activist Aaron Schwartz before his tragic death about 6 months ago, and it was called DeadDrop. And unfortunately, you know, I mean, the project was really great, but unfortunately there was no one that was really around to take care of it and make sure that it got updated and to make sure that the time and money and resources were invested into it to make sure it was the most secure thing possible. So we ended up at Freedom of the Press Foundation taking it over officially yesterday. We renamed it SecureDrop, and we're actually going to go around to media organizations and help them install it, give them technical assistance, and even provide them updates down the road when we fix bugs or make things easier to use, so that, you know, we're basically trying to take all of the pain out of creating these systems for media organizations so they can just go ahead and use them.
Wow. So, well, first of all, I guess I didn't realize that WikiLeaks had to pull their submission system. So they've just been, maybe they have documents they haven't released yet, but that's it for them, huh?
Right. You know, they've been talking a long time about getting another system online. You know, I think there's a few things that WikiLeaks has to worry about that many media organizations don't. Number one, they have a huge high profile. They're outside the U.S. You know, the U.S. government is much more hostile to them, may not consider them a media organization, even though they, of course, are. So they have a higher threat model than most news organizations. So I think they've been taking their time trying to carefully craft one. But, you know, it's a hard thing to do. So, you know, we're hoping that we can kind of spread this type of technology to media organizations around the country and eventually around the world so that there's not this one pressure point where if the U.S. government doesn't like one submission system, it can just take that one down and then all of a sudden, you know, there are no more. You know,
right.
We'd like there to be 100 WikiLeaks, not just one.
Yeah, I mean, that's really great, especially, you know, it doesn't go without saying, I guess, the Freedom of the Press Foundation, one of y'all's board members and co-founders is Glenn Greenwald, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so when you say we, that includes him in this decision-making, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, Glenn's really excited about this project, too. And
well, and as we know, I'm going somewhere with this. As we know, he's now got this giant new project of his own, and he's not trying to hog this technology for himself. He wants to see this same WikiLeaks type upload your secret document system installed on the website of every newspaper in the world, basically, is what you're saying. He's trying to push
absolutely.
This, too.
Absolutely. You know, as a journalist, he, of course, has, you know, a competition with other journalists and other news organizations to get stories out first. But above all that, I mean, you know, Glenn's philosophy is a very strong supporter of press freedom for all news organizations. And he obviously believes that all news organizations should have the type of technology that would allow them to do this. And, you know, when you think about the Obama administration's war on whistleblowers, where they've prosecuted more than all other administrations combined, the big reason they can do this now is because of the digital trail of emails and phone calls that reporters and sources leave all over the place. You know, they don't have to get reporters to testify in front of grand juries anymore. They can just subpoena the emails. So this is a system that hopefully will fight back against that and will allow sources and journalists to stay a little safer than they have been.
Right. Man, I think that's just great, and I'm also imagining, in fact, I'm remote viewing with my magical Jedi powers, people in Washington, D.C. crying their eyes out, and not just there, but in capitals all over the world as their intelligence agencies report the existence of this thing. What are they going to do with you, Trevor? Damn it, you're undermining their entire legitimacy with this.
Well, you know,
you're going to be an enemy of 192 states. Not just this one.
Well, this, I look at this thing as a safety valve. You know, there are times in this country, even though, you know, we claim to have a democracy that's always transparent, that the transparency avenues break down, whether it's the courts, the Congress, or the executive branch. You know, the NSA story is the quintessential example of this. And so when there is this safety valve there that the government knows about, that whistleblowers can safely get documents to the press so they can publish them, when there's no other resort, they may think twice about keeping things secret to begin with. And, you know, if nobody ever leaks to this system at various news organizations, but the government then decides to be more transparent because they know it's there, I think even in that case, it's worth it.
Right, but that's not going to happen. What's going to happen is this is going to be a huge success. Because, look, the truth of the matter is there's a lot wrong. And there's a lot of people who want to blow the whistle. But you know what? They got, you do know very well. Everybody knows. They got mortgages. They got wives. They've got kids. They've got risks that they're not willing to take. But you know what? You want to make it easy for them. It's like, why not smuggle some coke if you have an invisibility device or something, right? You're taking all the risk out of it. So go right ahead and blow the whistle, man. Your boss is doing the wrong thing, violating the rights of the American people. Let them know.
I mean, I absolutely think that, people don't say things because they're fearful of reprisals, even though they know the things that they want to say are in the public's right to know. And if we can make that just a little bit easier for people to take a little bit of the risks out of it. I mean, we got to remember here, there's still risks. You know, it's very brave of many whistleblowers to stick their neck out, whether they're doing it anonymously or letting the world know who they are. But if we can make it just a little bit safer for them, it's well worth it. And, in the end, it will make our press stronger, but it will also make our country stronger.
Yeah. Well, you know, I want to go back to something that you mentioned there about all these prosecutions, because I've spoken with Ray McGovern and Colleen Rowley in the last couple of days, and they've both said the same thing about Edward Snowden, which is that he said that Thomas Drake, first of all, was his inspiration for standing up and being a whistleblower, but it was also Thomas Drake was also his inspiration for going ahead and just giving the motherload of documents to Glenn Greenwald and not screwing around with going to the higher-ups and going to the Senate and whatever, because he had already seen that that doesn't work. That'll just get you prosecuted, trying to do it by the book. So you might as well just give it all to Glenn. And so I just thought that, you know, it's fitting as much of a tantrum as they're throwing over this thing up there in D.C. that it's their fault. If they had just treated Drake with an ounce of decency whatsoever, there probably wouldn't be a Snowden at all.
Yeah, that's the thing. You know, Thomas Drake tried to do everything by the book. He, like you said, he went to Congress, he went to the Inspector Generals, he went to his superiors, and they all rejected him. And even when he went to the journalists, he never actually gave the journalists anything classified, and he still got prosecuted. It's just the quintessential example of a vindictive prosecution against somebody who should be considered an American hero. And, it's exactly the reason why Edward Snowden and people like him will go to the press first. And it should, you know, really signal to the government that they have to completely revamp their system, because the idea that these people should be, prosecuted and exiled is just absurd. And, we should be celebrating their willingness to come forward.
Right. And, you know, this is something that kind of has been coming up on this show over the years, really since I started talking about this stuff with Dan Ellsberg years ago, about the whistleblowers, especially in the military. You look at these guys over there getting their legs blown off, fighting for Hamid Karzai or whoever, you know, takes power next there, and whatever form of government we created that'll last for a week and a half after the last American leaves. Geez, it seems like liberating classified documents that reveal real wrongdoing and doing a few years in prison or maybe even a couple of dozen years in prison is nothing compared to losing your life or losing your limbs. People are taking huge risks over there. In the entire national security state, they're taking huge risks. They might as well be taking those risks to tell the truth to the American people about what's really going on in their name and with their money and at their expense. you know, in terms of creating new enemies for them to have to deal with too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, part of the a lot of what whistleblowers have uncovered in the last 10 years have, you know, it's stuff that ends up hurting us overseas, in the sense that, you know, not that it should never be revealed, but that the government should never have been doing it to begin with. And, you know, it's stuff like the torture at Abu Ghraib, you know, the drone strikes, the CIA secret prisons, all of this stuff that our government should never be doing and has only come to light because of whistleblowers. And these whistleblowers end up making our country a better place because, you know, hopefully when they reveal this stuff, at least some reform happens, even if it's slow and even if it's, you know, like pulling teeth trying to get the government to reform. By exposing this stuff, they're actually helping, you know, the soldiers who are defending this country and everyone else by making the government just a little more honest. And so, you know, we hope that we can at least help a little bit along the way with Secure Drop.
Right. Again, it's Trevor Tim from the Freedom of the Press Foundation. Dan Ellsberg and Glenn Greenwald and others are involved in this thing. And we're talking about this new thing, Secure Drop, which was developed by Aaron Swartz, who, of course, the national government persecuted to death for the non-crime of downloading some journals and sharing them with no one. They drove him to suicide with their persecution. But anyway, everyone, please take note of this. It's at pressfreedomfoundation.org, pressfreedomfoundation.org. You know, anyone in media, make sure they know about this and that they can get involved in this, that they can have their own Secure Drop, that your organization, too, can be its own WikiLeaks in this world. And, man, this really is something else. And the promise here, the potential here is unlimited, certainly beyond my pathetic imagination, Trevor. So congratulations on this. Thank you for doing this. And I'm sure it's going to change the world. You know what? Honestly, let's go ahead and talk about the Greenwald thing here until the break. We got about 3-4 minutes. I want to hear what you think about this new project. Seems to me, if I can go ahead and hyperbolize and whatever, that whatever exactly happens with this, that it's going to be huge. That it's going to change journalism itself from now on, kind of a thing. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm really excited about what this project could potentially be. I mean, you know, Glenn Greenwald has obviously been on the forefront of these NSA stories, and he's been one of the loudest and most articulate supporters of civil liberties and digital rights for the past decade. And, you know, to have the backing of somebody as respected as Piero Midyar, who wants to not only facilitate Glenn Greenwald's journalism, but all sorts of other journalists who have an independent voice and speak to First Amendment principles and really do aggressive, hard-hitting reporting. You know, I can't imagine a better situation for, you know, not just the people, but also the who read the news, but also the media, who now will have to compete with this organization and hopefully get a little more aggressive on their reporting so they can keep up with them as well.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly what previous caller to the show said was, what are you going to do now, CNN and MSNBC and the rest of you, when these guys are just making you pale by comparison? It's going to be on. The competition is going to be fierce now, and they're not going to have a choice but to try to adjust to the new reality, which is a lot of fun for me. Just the anticipation is, it's like Thanksgiving dinner coming up or something. I just can't hardly wait at all. So good deal. And by the way, in case you're just tuning in and you know, you've been under a rock for a day and a half or whatever, the deal is the guy that's the founder of eBay, he's got $8 billion, and he's putting up, he told this one reporter anyway, that he's putting up as much as he was willing to pay for the Washington Post, $250 million into this thing. So this is like when Ted Turner decided he was going to put his fortune into media, kind of, you know, go from billboards to TV or something. This is a huge thing. This is a new world starting now. And with Glenn Greenwald, a fierce Bill of Rights advocate, at the charge of it. I just think it's going to be great. We're all anticipation over here. Now, I got to keep you on hold through the break, Trevor. We've got to take this short break. Screwed up the last two. But when we come back, I want to go over some NSA revelations coming out recently with you. Thanks very much for holding. Trevor Tim, everybody. EFF.org. PressFreedomFoundation.org.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council of the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, all Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at libertystickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush, 2016. FDR, no longer the worst president in American history. The National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952. And USA, sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at libertystickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at thebumpersticker.com. Libertystickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Coming up, Reza Marashi from the NIAC to talk about the Iran talks. That's right, we're going to talk about talks. It's going to be great. But right now, we're talking with Trevor Tim from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And these Snowden revelations keep coming, and I guess here's a segue. Greenwald told Time Magazine, or they were quoting him telling somebody or something, that, oh yeah, the good stuff? We haven't published that yet. What? What do you think he's talking about there? You know, at my most paranoid, I think, well, it's got to be the webcams, right? They're hijacking everybody's webcam whenever they feel like it. And because so far, all of my worst paranoid delusions have come true in these Snowden documents, Trevor. So that's my next one. Either that or they've got my own shadow spying on me. Is that it?
Yeah, I am very much looking forward to this, too. You know, I don't know anything besides what the public knows about what's in the documents we haven't seen, but I'm assuming there's a lot more to come because Glenn keeps saying there's a lot more to come, and every time he says that, he comes out with an explosive new story. You know, we know he's been working with Jeremy Scahill, the great reporter who's been working for The Nation the last few years, has the new movie Dirty Wars out, and has really done a lot of innovative work around drone strikes in Yemen and Somalia and all sorts of special forces operations around the globe. And so, you know, there's, you know, they talked about in one article the NSA somehow teaming up with some sort of assassination team, which we can assume is probably drone strikes, given that the Washington Post also reported the NSA has helped locate targets for the CIA and special forces when it comes to drone strikes in Pakistan and Yemen. So, you know, that's just a pure conjecture, but we know it's probably going to be explosive, given, you know, those two guys who are both top-notch working together.
You think the webcam thing is crazy town, at least for now?
Well, I mean, I don't think the NSA is hacking into random U.S. citizens' webcams and looking at what they're doing. But I do know that it's very possible that they certainly would have that ability if they wish, the technical ability at least. I don't know about the legal authority. Of course, they don't have the legal authority to. But they have, you know, as we've seen with all of these other leaks, that they have an incredible ability to hack into wherever they wish. And, you know, if you are a target of the NSA, even if you use, you know, some of the most encrypted technologies, they'll somehow find a way into your computer. And, you know, it would be great if they focused using those powers that they have on, you know, suspected terrorists that they have probable cause to believe committed a crime. You know, like surveillance is supposed to work in this country, rather than this, you know, blanket type of surveillance where they scoop up everybody's communications. But luckily, they don't have enough human beings to even look at all the webcams, even if that was possible. So, you know, I certainly think it's a technical possibility. And Believe me, I am one of those people who puts a sticker over their webcam when they're not using it. So I wouldn't call that paranoid, but it's, you know, at least they're not doing it on a mass scale.
Yeah. Well, and now, when you put the sticker over it, is it the national government you're most concerned about, or is it something someone else, just identity thieves, that kind of thing, or do you have a point?
Yeah, it could very well be identity thieves. I mean, I think you may have saw a few weeks ago the Miss America contestant had someone hack into her computer and take webcam pictures. There's all sorts of stories about people who rent computers from all sorts of, you know, tech stores, you know, like rent-to-own computers that end up taking pictures of people. You know, getting spyware on your computer and having people get a hold of your webcam is certainly something that everybody should be aware of, that it is possible to happen. Right. And, you know, putting a sticker over the camera is really easy. You know, you can just use a post-it note, take it off whenever you need to use the camera. Right. You know, it definitely doesn't hurt.
Well, and if criminals can do it, the national government sure as hell can do it, right?
Exactly.
All right.
You know, they're using the same techniques.
So now, of the latest revelations, I'm sorry, we're almost out of time, actually, but of the latest revelations, which do you think are the most important, the buddy list and the contact lists, or what else has come out lately that blew your socks off here?
Well, yeah, so the story in the Washington Post just a couple days ago by Barton Gellman, who also has some of the Edward Snowden documents, was really interesting. You know, they talked about how the NSA has been scooping up millions and millions of people's IM buddy lists and email contact address books. So basically, they're trying to collect every email address in the world. And of course, this includes millions of U.S. email addresses. So we don't have any idea what they're doing with these email addresses, but they know it's a very good possibility that they have your email address. And you know, are they querying that email address against all their other databases? Who knows? But, you know, it's just this the next step in their invasion of privacy, again, that we never knew that they were doing, and that we may have objected to if they ever tried to tell us about it. But they're doing it in complete secrecy, obviously. You know, there was another great story by Laura Poitras and James Risen in the New York Times a couple weeks ago about how they're also trying to create social profiles of everybody's, you know, Facebook connections and, you know, mapping, you know, who your friends are. And I'm sure this, the buddy lists and addresses that they're getting are connected to this same program. And so it will certainly be interesting to see the next wave of stories that comes out and hopefully shed some more light on this.
Oh, Trevor, I'm sitting here. I'm sorry. I'm asking you a question with my mic all the way off. That time, I overdid it. It happens. Do you think that the general narrative has gotten through the American people that, no, really, they're compiling pretty much a total information awareness about your entire life and your little sisters, too? I mean, is that really getting through, do you think?
You know what? I think there's really been a sea change in public opinion about privacy in the last 4 months because of the Edward Snowden disclosures. I mean, we've seen like 20-point swings. The fact that all of these polling places are now saying, in the first time in the history of polling, that privacy way outranks the fears of privacy invasions way outrank the fears of terrorism in this country. And you know, we're seeing Congress hopefully are going to be responding in the next few weeks. You know, there's already over a dozen bills introduced in Congress. There's about to be a huge bill introduced in Congress that will have the support of a lot of members. And so, you know, hopefully we can see some real reform coming up the next few weeks. But then we got to remember, obviously, the national security state is still very strong, and they have their own supporters. And so, you know, we have to stay vigilant and make sure we, you know, speak as loud as possible so that they continue to hear us.
Right. All right. Thanks very much, Trevor. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, everybody, that's the great Trevor Tim from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. They're the front lines of this thing, EFF.org, and also PressFreedomFoundation.org. Check out the secure drop there. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new project, Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com. They've got two new audiobooks read by the deepest voice in libertarianism, the great historian Jeff Riggenbach. Our Last Hope, Rediscovering the Lost Path to Liberty by Michael Meharry of the 10th Amendment Center is available now. And Beyond Democracy, co-authored by Frank Karsten of the Mises Institute Netherlands and journalist Carl Beckman, will be released this month. And they're only just getting started. So check out listenandthink.com. You may be able to get your first audiobook absolutely free. That's Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. You like coffee? Me too. Hey, if you're a true connoisseur, you need to try an amazing new roaster out of L.A., Tonks Coffee. These guys are fanatical about delivering the best coffee beans in the world. They get the beans directly from the growers, roast them, and then ship them to you within 24 hours. They're as fresh as can be. Tonks is a subscription-only service, and they're offering a free sample to listeners to this show. Give it a try. If you like it, you can sign up. Then every 2 weeks, you get a new batch of incredible coffee beans roasted to perfection. If you're hitting the cafe or drive-thru most mornings, this is a better and more economical way to get great coffee. Go to tonks.org/liberty. That's tonx.org/liberty.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Next up is Reza Marashi. He used to work in the State Department. Now he's at NIAC, NIAcouncil.org. It's the National Iranian American Council. And they work to promote peace and good relations between that state and this one. Welcome back to the show, Reza. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me back.
So what's the good word?
Oh, the good word, if we're talking about my issue, is U.S.-Iran relations, more generally. More specifically, is that there was a positive round of negotiations between Iran and the permanent members of the U.N. Security Council, plus Germany. The reason why they were positive is two key reasons. Let's just cut to the chase. One, for the Iranians and both the Americans moved a little bit further towards the middle, if you will. They both compromised. And to date, when one side's been willing to compromise, the other side really hasn't been. What does that mean? That means that the American side, together with the European allies, decided to have conversations with the Iranians about what this all might look like at the end of the negotiation process. Up to this date, the Bush administration before and the Obama administration currently has so far avoided those kinds of conversations, and that made the Iranians very skittish for a whole host of reasons. But then the Iranians themselves were also much more forthcoming about the details of their nuclear program and what they might be willing to do in terms of limitations on their program and what they might expect in return. They were much more concrete. All of this is very positive. It injects momentum into the diplomatic process. That doesn't mean that the problem can be solved overnight, but it does mean that we're finally getting down to business in a way that I don't think we've seen over the past 4 to 5 years. Mm-hmm.
So in other words, the Iranian chamberlains are doing their best to appease the American aggressor.
No, it's actually quite the opposite. Quite the opposite. The approach that hardliners and extremists both in Tehran and in Washington have taken up to date has only exacerbated the conflict, and it's made sanctions increase on Iran more and more when Iranian hardliners did extremist-type activities. And it's made Iran's nuclear program advance technologically, creating new facts on the ground, as American hardliners and extremists put more and more pressure on. So this cycle of escalation has created an incentive for both sides to walk back from the brink of a military confrontation that I think they'd independently seek to avoid.
Yeah. All right, so now, I guess, can you give us the word from Geneva about, I mean, I guess they're saying everybody's getting along just great. Can you tell us, you know, how far it is that I don't really understand all the ins and outs of all this diplomacy stuff. They've certainly come a lot further than just agreeing to have some talks, but they haven't really shaken hands on even the outline of the deal yet, really, have they?
Well, that's what they've been getting down to for the first time in a long time, is the outlines of what a deal might look like. You know, both sides agreed to not leak details of the negotiations to the press, but what we've been able to gather so far from people in Geneva that were there during the negotiations, not in the room, but were there to talk to the negotiators after the fact, is that, you know, there was a willingness to compromise on core issues and have very frank discussions about these kinds of core issues that neither side was really willing to have prior. Before it turned into a blame game where, you know, the Americans would blame the Iranians would blame the Americans.
Right.
But now, they, you know, both sides have kind of said, okay, enough's enough. Let's see what we can do. The reason why that's important is because when you're actually talking about the core issues that need to be discussed in order to resolve the conflict, then we're really going to be giving diplomacy the chance that it deserves. Then that we're actually taking steps to check the box, for example, in ways that we didn't in the run-up to the Iraq War. and some might even say the war in Afghanistan or NATO's invasion of Libya.
Right.
So you, doing this kind of due diligence is critical. And if it continues, like both the Iranians and the Americans deserve praise for what happened today. And if it continues, then we should continue to praise them for taking the proper steps to find a peaceful solution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's more or less what Greg Thielman wrote this morning, or maybe yesterday, that I read, focusing more on the Iranians' lack of bluster and blame and, you know, like not pointing out inconvenient things like Israeli assassinations of their scientists and that kind of stuff, which I guess the way he put it, they were focusing really on talking with each other rather than on posturing for the external audience, that is really the key.
Yeah, I think so. I think what we're seeing now is the fact that Iran has politics, and you have a new president in Iran who has brought in a new cabinet to staff the various positions in different ministries. And these people have a different idea on how diplomacy should work and a different way that they prefer to interact with the world as representatives of the Iranian government. That doesn't mean that problems can be solved overnight, but it does mean that it makes it a little bit easier for the process to move forward. It also makes it easier for the United States to move forward with the diplomatic process in ways that, frankly, it hasn't prior to these most recent talks. It's going to be very interesting to see how this process moves forward because both sides, you know, just because the extremists on both sides have been boxed in, it doesn't mean they've gone away. And I think American negotiators and Iranian negotiators are well aware of the fact that they could potentially rear their ugly heads at any given time. So they're going to have to continue to be brave and take risks for peace. That's going to be critical going forward.
Right. Yeah. Move quickly. Well, so now, I mean, the bottom line on the American side, because isn't it correct that everybody in the whole world who's interested in the subject already knows the outline of the deal? It's basically the same one that Obama offered him back in 2009 that Brazil and Turkey worked in 2010. It's, you know, doesn't have to be exact, but more or less stop enriching to 20%, sign the additional protocol, but that would require the Americans recognizing, at least de facto, if not officially stating it this way, it would mean them recognizing Iran's right to enrich uranium and leave the Natanz facility at least open for business and enriching uranium for their nuclear reactor, for their electricity program, and for the long term, which I don't know if that would mean they'd have to just ignore their own Security Council resolution on the issue or repeal it or what, but that's the only real question here, right, is are the Americans willing to go ahead and recognize civilian enrichment at 3.6%? Because I think the Iranians have been willing to make this deal all along, pretty much, at least since Obama came to power here.
I think you're raising really important points, and everything that you said is going to be a core tenet of what any confidence-building measure or final deal, frankly, would end up looking like. The only thing I would tack on the back end of what you just said is that the Iranians want to go a few steps further and everything that you outline and say, where is this all going? Where is this leading? What kind of relationship do you want to have if we make this kind of deal? Because what the Iranians aren't interested in is making the kind of compromises that we're asking them to make. And then we, of course, make a few compromises in return, but the relationship continues to be negative. Uh-huh. And there continues to be this U.S.-Iran Cold War, if you will. They want this to lead somewhere so that the overall relationship goes to a better place, not just the conflict over the nuclear program. And that's what's most critical, because
right. If
we don't use this as a springboard to have that kind of conversation about what the end game looks like, what does this all mean and where is it all going? Like, it's like the old saying goes, if you don't know where you're going, any road can take you there. And that's very dangerous in diplomacy. So everything that you said about the technical details of Iran's program, everything that you said about what the United States would have to be willing to accept as it pertains to what Iran's program will look like, the technical details, the level of enrichment, number of centrifuges, you name it, across the board, inspections, verifications, all that stuff, 100% has to be there. But also we have to know where the overall relationship between the U.S. and Iran is going. You know, we can't be negotiating with Iran on the one hand and trying to overthrow the government on the other hand, right? We're going to have to make a firm decision on what we want. And frankly, so do the Iranians. So that's the most optimistic thing that's emerged from Geneva so far, is they've finally started to have that kind of conversation.
Do you think the Iranians would settle for, we'll give you a real and serious nuclear deal, but we're going to still threaten you all the time. But just ignore it. you know, that kind of thing?
No, I don't think the Iranians would accept that. And I can't tell
you. Because, look, I want a permanent peace here. You know me. I want to.
Absolutely.
I think that even from the point of view of the empire, the number one most important thing on the agenda ought to be to befriend the most important Shia power on Earth right now. Whatever. Even from bad guy American imperialist point of view, that's my point of view, is make peace with Iran yesterday. But I'm wondering, you know, if they would settle for, we're not going to have too much of a future, but at least we're not going to have the nuclear issue to beat you over the head with anymore. And we'll only beat you over the head over Hezbollah and smaller stuff, you know? I don't know.
That's an excellent question, and that's the kind of stuff that the Iranians want to talk about as it pertains to what's the end game. What does this all look like when everything's been negotiated? They want to negotiate on things not only limited to the nuclear program. They want to talk about regional security, so that includes Hamas and Hezbollah. That includes Afghanistan. That includes Iraq. That includes Syria. They want to expand the agenda and expand the horizons. They understand, though, and I think the United States understands as well, that the nuclear issue is probably the most pressing issue. So if we make some progress on that and de-escalate tensions in that realm, then it opens up the possibility to take momentum from those negotiations and apply that momentum to talks over these other issues. And that's how you create real and lasting peace. So that's really the most positive thing that's come so far from these talks. They scheduled a new round of talks to follow up. I believe it's November 7th and 8th or 6th and 7th. Basically, it's 3 weeks' time. And that's good, because what that allows both sides to do is to come back to their respective capitals, go over what was discussed, and then follow up with more concrete ideas and more concrete counterproposals. And that's the magic of diplomacy.
That's funny. All right, well, so it seems like if Barack Obama really wants to try to do this, and he's really telling John Kerry that, like, hell yeah, we got to see this thing through kind of a thing, the worst he has to deal with is John McCain and Bill Kristol. And he can handle them if he really wants to try. That's our hardliners, right? But what about the Iranian hardliners? How tough is it? And you can disagree with what I just said, by the way, all you feel like, by the way. Say whatever you want. But I'm more interested in who are the Iranian hardliners, and how difficult is it for Rouhani to do what he's doing, considering their domestic politics?
Oh, it's certainly going to be difficult. And we should understand that, and we should walk into these negotiations with Iran clear-eyed about the fact that Rouhani, the president of Iran, is handling his hawks, but he hasn't gotten rid of them. I think what's important to realize is that there's never been this much unity inside Iran's political system about pursuing negotiations with the United States and taking steps to improve the overall relationship. When I say unity, I don't mean 100% unity. But there's never been this much cohesion in the Iranian political system, really since 1979. Iran's politics have always been very, very factional, and different factions have always been attacking one another to try and get credit for any kind of improvement with Iran's relations with the outside world. And frankly, some Iranian political factions are opposed to improving relations with the outside world because they thrive in isolation. Thankfully, Iranian extremists have been sidelined, perhaps only temporarily, but sidelined. But there are key conservative factions and key conservative politicians inside of Iran, including the leader himself, Mr. Ali Khamenei, that are so far backing President Rouhani's initiatives vis-a-vis the United States. So it's very difficult to torpedo the process, but not impossible, if the leader himself is backing it. So the quicker that the Iranians can make process in the negotiations, and the quicker that they can deliver something tangible, the more political space they'll have to continue to pursue this path. And I think that's why they're trying to move quickly.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, remind me, back a few months ago when Rouhani was elected, he was not the guy that the Supreme Leader preferred at the time, correct?
By most accounts, no. The leader himself always says that I don't have a preferred candidate, but I think most Iran analysts would tell you that his preferred candidate probably was the most hardline candidate of the handful that were approved to run.
Was the most what?
Was the most hardline, or the most conservative of the conservatives, if you will. But the individual who ended up winning was Rouhani, who ran as a more moderate and more pragmatic. And I use these terms moderate and pragmatic relative
sure.
to the people he was running against. You know, a moderate in the United States is very different than a moderate in Iran. But the Iranian people went to the polls overwhelmingly and voted for this guy. So much so that I think the leader himself and other conservative politicians in Iran who maybe don't want the diplomatic process to move forward and improve were forced to accept the results and give them a chance. Because any authoritarian government is always going to be concerned that the disconnect between the government and the people becomes irreparable. And because of the post-election crisis in 2009 in Iran, never really got resolved. 4 years later, people went to the polls and voted overwhelmingly. I am personally of the opinion that hardliners in Iran realized that, you know, they could do some funny business with the elections once, but they couldn't get away with it twice.
Right. And now, back when, let's see, in 2003, Rouhani played some role in the so-called golden offer. Well, that's what Gordon Prather called it. I don't know if there's a popular term for it, but it was the Iranian great peace offer that said, hey, we'll deal our entire nuclear program, but we'll also deal with you on issues of Hezbollah, on issues of energy, and whatever you want. Let's be friends kind of a thing. And that was the one where even the Swiss diplomat that delivered the peace offer got in trouble over it. And the Gareth Porter broke the story with the Leverets as his, well, I guess it was Leverett and Mann then, as his sources. So anyway, I was just wondering if you could remind us, what was Rouhani's role there? And was it Khatami or it was Rafsanjani was the president? It was Khatami at the time was the president, right?
That's right. It was Khatami who was the president. Rouhani was the chief nuclear negotiator at the time. This is 10 years ago, by the way, that they put forward a document that expressed a willingness to discuss everything from Iraq to the nuclear program to terrorism, regional security, essentially every single thing that the U.S. government says we have a problem with the Iranians because they do this. The Iranians submitted a document and said, okay, we're willing to talk to you about it. And not only did they say we're willing to talk to you about the things that you don't like that we do, here's a list of stuff that we'd like to talk to you about that you do that we don't like. and frankly, that's how diplomacy works. And Rouhani was actually leading the nuclear negotiations at the time, which were separate from this grand bargain offer, if you will. But what's important to remember is that Rouhani and Zarif, Javad Zarif, who is the foreign minister of Iran currently, he was the UN ambassador at the time, 10, 11 years ago. These two men were two of the critical actors that spearheaded both processes at the time, both processes being the grand bargain offer and then the separate process of negotiating with the European Union. Rouhani was leading those negotiations. So not only did the Bush administration refuse the grand bargain offer that the Iranians put forward, they also refused to accept a very reasonable agreement on Iran's nuclear program that the European Union negotiated with Rouhani at the time.
Yeah.
And if we look back at what the Iranians agreed to, it's far more minimal in terms of what their actual nuclear program would look like in terms of technology and substance than what we're going to end up having to live with today.
Sure. Yeah, Natanz wasn't even a hole in the ground in 2003.
Yeah, so, you know, they were asking for a handful of centrifuges and enrichment on Iranian soil. That's what they were asking for in 2003. That's the essence of it, you know, give or take a few things here or there. It's going to be a lot more than that today. The price that we're going to have to pay for a peaceful solution to Iran's nuclear program has increased exponentially over the past 10 to 11 years, largely, but not entirely, but largely because of the Bush administration's unwillingness to accept what the Europeans were able to negotiate with Iran at that time. And this isn't my opinion. The former foreign minister of the UK and another former European foreign ministers are on the record saying all of this.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's past is prologue, as Shakespeare used to say. And we need to understand who we're dealing with at the other side of the negotiating table. And who we're dealing with now is somebody who's tried to do this before there were any of these sanctions on oil and gas and banking, right? Before there was any of this pressure. So he has a demonstrated track record of wanting to do this, and he has the backing of key hardliners in Iran. So if we can't do it now with these guys, I question whether or not we really are interested in doing it.
Yeah. Well, you know, whatever else is true about the regime there, same with Assad in Syria and Gaddafi in Libya, they were useful allies in fighting Al-Qaeda. And those are America's actual enemies, All Iran ever did to America is declare independence. Al-Qaeda attacked and killed 3,000 people, and that was after trying to sink one of our ships and bombing two of our embassies and bombing the barracks at Khobar Towers. Those are our actual enemies, and we're willing to support, if not outright support them, at least ship guns and money that end up in their hands as they fight a war in Syria now, because the Syrian government is an ally of Iran. And we're actually backing our own enemies against Iran and its allies. The only reason I can think of, obviously there's resentment over the Declaration of Independence of 79, but really it's because of Israel. Israel's concerned about Hezbollah, and Syria and Iran back Hezbollah, and Iran backs Hezbollah by way of Syria. And so since we didn't take them up on their golden offer where they were willing to deal with Hezbollah and force Hezbollah to become a political party without guns anymore, I guess we have to back Al-Qaeda in Syria now. I mean, this is the kind of mess that we get in for turning these opportunities down. And in fact, one more thing about this real quick, and then I'll shut up and you can say what you want about it, is that at the time of the golden offer, one of the things in there was, and we'll deal with you, we'll work together on Iraq. Well, what did America do? America didn't just fight a war for the Shiites in Iraq and to hand them the capital city, but specifically the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, Abdulaziz al-Hakim, who was the hand-picked leader of Sistani and Khomeini. This is the guy that they wanted Bush to put in power, and Bush tried to put him and his men in power as best he could, and the only thing that happened was Hakim ended up dying, and Sadr and his allies ended up, and the Dawa Party ended up inheriting a bit more of the power. But basically, George Bush's entire Iraq war project was to do exactly what the Ayatollah, I mean, specifically what the Ayatollah Khomeini wanted him to do as far as the Supreme Islamic Council, etc., and yet wouldn't work with him on it at all. And so it was a complete disaster, and almost a million people died.
I think that the Bush administration strategically made so many mistakes in the Middle East from beginning to end. And the Obama administration has continued a lot of them, I'll be the first to admit. But I want to give the Obama administration credit now because they've taken a few steps. We should acknowledge good behavior. We should reinforce good behavior, right, when we see it from our political leaders. And I think Barack Obama and John Kerry and Chuck Hagel are three men who genuinely want to solve this peacefully. I disagree with some of the ways they've gone about it over the past 5 years, but I think their bottom line is the same as you and mine. If it doesn't get solved, at the end of the day, we're going to have to look very carefully at what mucked up the process. But the fact that they're trying and they're willing to talk about an end game with the Iranians, about what the relationship will look like at the end, provides the opportunity, far from guaranteed, but an opportunity, the first time in decades, to maybe move away from some of the stuff that you were just talking about how America strategically makes mistakes in the Middle East, and perhaps get it right. Far be it from making promises that that's going to be the case, because I understand how difficult it is, but if we have a window of opportunity and our political leaders are pursuing it, then we should reinforce that good behavior and let them know that as American citizens, we're the majority. The people that support them in using diplomacy and peaceful methods, we're the majority, and we have their back. So hopefully this will continue, but your concerns are warranted because the historical reference points that you just made, I mean, you know, it's there. It happened. And until we start to act a little bit differently in that part of the world, I don't see how we're going to be able to change the paradigm.
Well, you know, I certainly agree with you that, well, you could never get me to praise a president, but I certainly am able to recognize that if it had been McCain or Romney in this situation, they wouldn't be talking with the Iranians like this at all. They would be both much worse on this. So, you know, it could be worse. If that's not the highest praise, it's the best they'll get out of me. But no, I mean, this is a real big deal. And honestly, you know, I can tell that, you know, the Saudis want what they want. And the arms dealers probably prefer that the Saudis are afraid of the Iranians. And, of course, the Israelis are afraid of a single atom of uranium existing anywhere in Persia, you know, at any time and that kind of thing. But other than that, it doesn't seem like there's any real purpose in America's Cold War with Iran other than a grudge from when I was too young, you know, when I was in preschool. You know what I mean? It's ridiculous.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of people would agree with you that it's reached the point of ridiculousness. It's long since. We're way past the point of ridiculous in terms of the U.S.-Iran relationship, and both sides deserve blame for poisoning the well, You know, one goes, sure. then the next goes. A lot of people have made their careers out of proving how nasty they can be to the other side. But I think now where we're at is we have an opportunity to move away from that. And the best way to move away from that, and frankly, I would argue personally, the only way to move away from that is courageous leaders that are willing to take risks for peace. If you look at this part of the world, more specifically the Middle East and the world more generally, things aren't going so well, not just for the United States, but for a lot of countries. It's going to be very tough for Barack Obama to get a foreign policy win. Iran provides a possibility. They've aligned themselves for a deal. And I would hope that the President of the United States would use the same kind of political fortitude to push back against the Congress and other extremists to at least see if it's possible, to probe and test this possibility. So far, so good, but it's going to take a lot more of what we've seen through this week.
Yep. Well, it's interesting the discrepancy between the polls of the masses of Americans. I think it was 75% said that they are in support of these talks, and then still the squeaky wheels up there are still squeaking. So you're right. It's going to take the Americans making their voices heard that we support the president's position on this. And no matter what you think of the healthcare thing, you got to, and Obama because of it or whatever, you still got to support these peace talks with Iran no matter what. And let them know that. That's my
yeah, opinion. Absolutely. No, I agree. You know, if you're not backing peace talks, then the real question is, what are you backing?
Right.
And that's an inconvenient question that a lot of people like to dance around or just outright ignore.
Yep. Hey, even Rand Paul, while calling for more sanctions somehow, is saying, let's make this deal, or let's make some... He's saying something about let's negotiate. I don't know what, but I'll take it, you know?
I'll take it, too.
Hey, thanks very much for your time again on the show, Reza. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
All right, everybody. That's Reza Marashi. He's a former State Department guy. And now at the NIAC, that's NIACouncil.org, NIACouncil.org, working for peace between America and Iran. And that's it for the show. We'll see you guys here tomorrow, 3 to 5 Eastern.